governor that I was surprised to see him.
Yeah.
And then you have, I haven't reread Tom McCall's book lately, but
right.
I just finished Governor Roberts for the second time,
right.
which is a long one. It's very good.
It is.
I did read Bob Straub's,
uh-huh.
but Chuck Johnson's book, have you
mm-hmm.
read it?
Yeah.
I thought that book was very interesting, and what I really want to do is go back and read them, you know, read McCall and Straub's book at the same time.
Do McCall, Straub, Betty Roberts.
Oh, wow.
And then you get a real parallel thing
okay.
going on.
But I also think, I mean, we think of McCall as this superhuman, superhero, right?
Right.
And I do believe some of it was Straub nipping at his heels.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's not the right word, but...
I think it's exactly the right.
I think McCall gets a lot of... people said that, you know, he always found the parade and got ahead of it, right?
Right.
Well, I think Straub was a lot of the parade.
Straub was a lot of the parade, and when you read my book, you're going to find out the legislature was a lot of the parade.
Right, yes.
In some ways that are, this is some things I want to ask you about.
Okay.
There's fascinating things. Vic, for instance, was accused of not supporting the bottle bill, which he supported the entire time. He sent it back to committee because he saw there was a fatal flaw in it right on the floor of the Senate.
Wow.
And so people use that, said, well, he was against it because he sent it back to kill it. He's like, he sent it back because it was going to cover every bottle. How could he tell? Because senators brought in all sorts of bottles, put them on their desk, and said, so is this going to be in it? Is this going to be in it?
Wow.
And he said, yeah, I read that, and no.
We have to narrow it.
And it wasn't his committee, but it was Betty Roberts' committee. Send it back. Vic, come back. Vic also, in 1963, is part of what became...
Thank you.
The birth of the DQQ. He's the committee that's looking at water issues and smoke issues. It's called smoke. It's not smog.
It was field burning, right?
But it was also in the cities where everybody burned coal.
Oh, wow.
And so he then is instrumental
that was
in
like
our
a,
environmental stuff.
I said not a decade, but Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Had just about 62.
Okay. All
yeah.
right. I had her in 68.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
62.
Wow.
And so he's at the beginning of that. The model that they eventually come up with is used to create the EPA.
Wow.
And so, you know, Vic, moderate, at best, Republican, is one of the founders of the environmental movement. I mean, this is weird.
This is so great. This will be the first book on him, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Aren't you excited?
Yeah. It's a blast.
Okay.
And I'm learning so much. All the Major 97 stuff.
Uh-huh.
Vic proposed something that was a 1%
grocery
tax in 82. If it had been 2.5, it would have raised exactly this much money. And
so,
where did he get that idea? From Mark Hatfield, who proposed a much smaller gross and net receipts tax in 1961 and 62.
So have you been to, do you use the Oregon archives at all in the Secretary
of State? I haven't, I use them from afar at this point.
Okay.
Because we have our archives.
Okay.
I've got to exhaust it and
okay.
then head out
all right.
the other thing.
You can also, I think, I know that Governor Barbara used it extensively when
yeah.
she was writing her book.
Yeah.
You can also, I'm sure, just call and, you know, let them
yeah.
know what you're looking for and they'll find it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And when I interview people here often, I don't know if you ran into John Yunker. But John,
I see him occasionally in town.
He's such a sweetie pie.
He is.
But when I interviewed him, he went and got letters that Vic had written to constituents on X thing.
Wow.
So
now all the constitutional officers,
mm-hmm.
All letters, everything are permanent public records, right?
Right.
Was that true? When
no, it wasn't. And so that's why we have so much stuff at
okay.
Pacific.
All right.
Some people, like one of his chief staffers, who was with him almost the whole time, Patty Medeo, who did natural resources, she just left her office and it went to the archives, but there were no rules. So Jerry Thompson took everything home as chief of staff.
No.
And Vic took tons of stuff home
no.
as ex-governor. And so there's stuff in attics still.
Ugh. This just breaks my heart.
Yeah. And some of it, I told you briefly when I saw you last December, there was an attempt on Vic's life during the machinations. And, you know, Jerry Thompson's got all that stuff. I now have it, but I don't have her permission to put it in our archives yet. I have it for my book,
okay.
And I've copied everything. But I don't know, I need her permission to put it. I mean, this is her handwritten notes. It's just tons of... So there, it's,
the world is very different in terms of permanent public records.
It's very, very different.
I just... Chris is on campaign side now, but I just... my understanding, moving from the Secretary of State's office to the Governor's office was different, I think, than current practices.
Yeah.
And so, for example, as Secretary of State, every note that I wrote, which was a lot, was permanently preserved, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that that was the practice in the Governor's office.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's really unfortunate because it sort of adds, it's the spice, right?
Oh, yeah.
It totally is. So.
Secret meetings on the Rajneeshis with the feds, the state, and all the locals there. Jerry and the governor basically said, we have to crack heads and get these people to work together. I have the handwritten notes. I have their signatures and their phone numbers where they all signed in. You know, all this kind of stuff. It's just, it's fantastic.
Just to compare, right?
Yeah.
So we have the occupation at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah.
Because of the safety issues.
Yeah.
My notes, not, you know, conversations that I had with the deputy attorney general, you know, exempted,
right,
from disclosure. But a year from now?
Yeah.
2 years from now?
Yeah. Whatever, it'll be out there.
Yeah.
Dave Frommeyer, the attorney general, told Jerry, you can't keep these notes because they could, the Rajneeshis could subpoena. But she said, the heck, that's the way it work. And so... they never were subpoenaed, but just a fascinating time. Because the public records law is just 1971-73. It's all still fresh. They're still working through it.
Yes.
So.
And it's evolved. How many? 500 exemptions and 18 volumes of the Oregon Revised Statutes?
Exactly.
So I'll just share my... sort of my exposure to ATIA came through my work on the Commission on Indian Services. So I came.
So you run the legislative
commission?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
For basically the entire time I was in the legislature. So it's a interesting story. I was appointed to replace Judy Bauman when she resigned. I don't remember the exact date. November of 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry Campbell was Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he's like, what are we going to do with this feminist from Southeast Portland, right? Mm-hmm. So he's like, put me on the Legislative Commission. I'll bury her there.
Right.
And that was my first exposure because... whether it was his leadership or his brainchild to create the commission, I don't know. But to the tribes in Oregon, he was the be-all to end-all, right? I mean, he was the creator of this commission.
Mm-hmm.
And no other state has anything like it.
Right.
I don't know where he got the idea from. But to this day, the tribes would say time immemorial, you know, ATIA is, you know, the creator of this incredible relationship that the state of Oregon has with the tribes. I ended up staying on the commission. The world changed for tribes because this was just after the National Gaming Rights Act, right? And you had a few of the tribes begin to acquire financial resources and with that political power. And it was interesting because when I moved to the Senate, they took me off for 6 months, and then the legislators didn't come, so they put me back on.
That's great.
But now we have 4 members of the legislature on the commission because it is so important, right? And it's so politically
powerful. Was that
powerful.
A statutory change?
It was a statutory change, yes. And it's the only creature like it in the United States to this day.
Yeah.
And so... for example, I went to Payamsha. I know I was Secretary of State at the time, so it would have been, you know, 09, 10. Mm-hmm. It was probably 09 or 11. And Governor Tia was there being honored, right,
yeah.
at Warm Springs.
Yeah.
And that was my interactions with him. And, you know, they treated him like he was the President of the United States.
Yeah.
And this was 20 years after he'd been governor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really extraordinary.
Yeah.
The commission honored him at the Capitol a couple of years ago. I was there for that.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And I think to this day, the tribes still hold him in that regard.
Yeah.
And now kind of Kulongowski is sort of taking that
right. mantle on. Right, and when Ted came on, you know, Vic was there to hold his hand and introduce him and, you know, plug him into all that. Because it's even as governor, and you're part of the sovereign thing, you're not, it's not, it's personal relationships.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the challenge is the change. So, you know, I'm sure for him becoming governor, the relationship is different than mm-hmm. when you are a legislator, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very different
with
the tribes.
Yeah.
So the other interactions that I had with him were, and it was in May before he passed away, there was an Asian Chamber of Commerce meeting, and he was there in full force, right? And his ties to the Asian community are also very strong, endearing, enduring, and endearing, I think. And it was obviously he created the international office in Tokyo.
Right.
And I know he did the TV from Oregon with
love.
So that was all his work. But for him to come, and he was quite frail at that point in time, was pretty remarkable. And I remember we sat at one of the overhangs and had a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He is to this day one of the people that I wish I could talk to. There's a handful of them. He is one of them.
Yeah.
Just because he was so encouraging and so supportive all the time.
Yeah.
He got the Statesman of the Year Award from OBA. I don't remember what year. I remember going up to him, and he just said, keep doing the great work. You're doing the right thing. All the time, he was encouraging.
Yeah, yeah. I interviewed Barbara just as you were either not quite governor or becoming governor. And I said, the next time you see the new governor, here's my advice. Channel Barbara Roberts and Vic Atien. Go.
So I think one of the reasons why, I mean, he remains in our memory, he's obviously the last Republican governor.
Right. No,
but
the latest. The latest Republican governor.
The most recent Republican governor. But I think people really liked him, right?
Yeah.
He was very, I think, endearing and enduring, but he was endearing.
Mm-hmm.
People just, regardless of what party or where they were from, he treated people with respect. He clearly liked people very, very much.
He lived long enough for people to look back and say, you know, that was really important.
Yes, exactly.
And so that's a tough thing.
So I think it was his I would describe it as compassion, right, for people. What was the other thing that I thought of? The other sort of standout to me, and I had it on my I had a desk cover when I was SOS, and there was an article, and I wasn't able to track it down. I think it might have been Steve Dean, but it was about the time he was driving to the hospital and he had a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
But he said, you know, and I can't remember the exact words, and I can't find the article because it's packed away and stuff, but he said, you know, put the people of Oregon first.
Right.
Set aside the politics. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
And for me, that's kind of the ballast, you know.
Yeah.
How do we look at stuff? We look at stuff through what we need to do, how we serve the people of Oregon.
Right. When he was on the tax committee, which he was forever, he would go in and he'd say up front if he decided how he was going to vote on it. And usually he was going to vote against whatever the bill was before the committee. But he said, and he looked out there, he said, well, it's going to pass the committee. And so we need to make this the best bill we can possibly make it. So when it does pass, and I'm going to vote against it, but when it does pass, it's the strongest we can possibly make it. And he had a penknife. He would take his penknife out. He would cut the bill so it was flat in front of him. And he was never the chair of the committee,
Right.
Because he was always in the minority.
And that's
and
the other
go
point.
Through and he would just, he'd underline and work hard and make it the best thing possible.
So that's a different view of being in the minority, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are two philosophies about being in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, and I was in the minority for 14 years of my 17 years in the legislature, it was about, you know, the bill's going to pass. How do you make it better? How do you delay its takeoff?
Right.
How do you make the route bumpy?
Right.
You know, how do you try and, excuse the analogy, crash land it, right?
Right.
In all, if you know you're going to lose, pick your fights very carefully and figure out what it is you can accomplish.
Yeah.
And I do not believe that Governor Kitzhaber, Governor Roberts, or Governor Klumkowski served any time when they were in the legislature in the minority.
No, I don't think so.
And I think that changes your perspective greatly.
Yeah.
So I chose as minority leader to figure out how we could impact things,
mm-hmm.
Make it better, change
mm-hmm.
the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you had to, you know, try and stop the bill.
Yeah.
But if you knew something was going to become law, I thought your time and energy was much better served figuring out how you make it better.
Yeah.
And I know that he did the absolute same thing. I think the other piece is the world has changed in politics,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more generationally and, you know, just sort of the different changing dynamics in the Republicans. But I received a lot of criticism as the caucus leader for not being more of a fighter, a
right.
blowhard, a
right.
whatever word you want to use, or throwing more bombs.
Yeah.
I just didn't feel that that was the most effective way to work in the institution.
Yeah.
And I know he totally saw the
and
world
he had
that
two
way.
Times when he was the minority leader, when it was relatively close, but he had two times when there were seven and then six Republicans. So as Wally Carson has said, we didn't need party discipline because it didn't matter at all.
Right, right. And so when I started in the Senate, it was 10-20.
Yeah.
We had 10 Democrats.
Yeah, yeah. You
they
were
didn't
the,
need us.
The quorum
right.
could happen.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. But I also served in 15-15 and 16-14 when the Republicans controlled. Gene Durfer was the Senate president.
Yeah.
And I knew he didn't have a full 16 on most things.
And Vic had that for two
yes.
of his times.
Yes.
So here's specific questions. You become in the majority party. Are you going to be the Senate president? You know, what's going to happen? Vic in 1971 was in a very similar situation. He had become the minority leader in a 14-16 split, but it was they used to have the coalition,
mm-hmm.
and so the coalition there and so. The Democrats say, we're going to nominate Bud Lentz, okay? And the Republicans go in and miffed Vic. He doesn't stay angry, but he remembers everything. They did not nominate him, the minority leader, to be the president of the Senate. And it stuck with him.
I did not know this story.
And I talked to the remaining live people from that Republican caucus, and they, I don't know, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, something happened here, guys. So
they're not telling you what happened.
Well, they're not telling you, but they're also in their mid and late 80s. So, I don't know. Eventually, John Burns, Republican or Democrat,
yes.
becomes.
Yeah, but
he was
a conservative.
Yeah, he was
very
acceptable
conservative
to them. Yeah.
Democrat.
Yeah. And then he also, when he becomes the president, he's actually really equitable. It's the last time that we really have more or less equal Republicans-Democrats running committees,
wow.
Which was a real common practice. It ended in the House when Bob Smith became the speaker as Republican. He said, end.
That doesn't surprise
me. It doesn't
me.
Surprise me at all either.
But I will say, and when are you finishing this book, and what is your publication deadline?
There is no publication deadline, and I hope next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think President Courtney has mm-hmm. worked very hard to bring back more of what I would describe as a co-leadership mm-hmm. situation mm-hmm. In key areas.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's both practical realities mm-hmm. of the dynamics of the Senate,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's also the kind of leader that he is. I remember having the conversation with Gene Durfler.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Gene remembers this. It was prior to redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, Gene, you should appoint, and the House should appoint, a bipartisan committee to do the redistricting plan. This would have been like 2000.
Right.
And to do a bipartisan redistricting plan. And he went, ha, 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 ha. Well, you know what happened?
Mm-hmm.
We had lawyers who beat him to the courthouse steps, and we won that battle.
Yeah.
And I think there is certainly the philosophy that a level of bipartisanship makes better policy for Oregonians.
So in your experience, you just said that Peter Courtney's, it's like his personality is doing this.
Yes.
So is it important, is that personality important, or is the party split in the more partisan era that we live in more important in one way or the other?
I think Peter's personality has an incredible influence on the functioning of the state Senate.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
And you also know I had a leadership battle.
Yes.
With the Senate president.
Yeah.
It was a little different. We were split 15-15. I was the caucus leader at the time.
Right.
Bev Carno.
Yeah.
I would describe her as a moderate Republican.
Yeah.
Was the other caucus leader. The Republicans wanted Peter as Senate president. They didn't want me
right.
as Senate president. And the agreement we made was that he would be Senate president.
So even without having the coalition, in effect, you ended up having the coalition.
Yes.
In terms of selecting leadership.
Yes, but it was a conscientious choice
yeah.
to have the Democrat have the gavel.
Right.
I thought that was a better choice
yeah.
for the issues and the agenda
yeah.
that I wanted to deliver on, or that the Democrats
right.
wanted to deliver on. It was very different than what happened in the House
mm-hmm.
when they were split.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they learned. The Republicans learned from that.
Yeah.
They did co-everything, right?
Yeah.
Nothing that anybody opposed moved through the House floor that
right.
time around.
Right.
In our 15-15 split, there was stuff that it probably wasn't influenced by party, but
mm-hmm.
by philosophy
yeah.
that moved forward because we didn't have the ultimate, you know, Republicans could kill anything or Democrats
right.
could kill anything. It was
right.
more about, you know, can you get the 16 votes?
Yeah.
And that's what controlled.
Okay, that's great. So now let's shift. So you're coming to the end of your legislative career. Why did you decide to run for state office? Even I ask, Vic did it. The last Republican that I can think of, I was just quickly thinking of it, is Lynn Snodgrass? Would she be the last one who was kind of in leadership and Republican and then ran? She ran for Secretary of State.
Did Lynn Lundquist run for something as well?
I'm not sure, but it's kind of that same
okay.
era. But you know, I'm looking at this election cycle. If this was 1978, Ferrioli and McLean would be running for governor because that's what Roger Martin and Vic Atiyah did.
Wow.
But we have a different...
The political landscape
yeah.
is very different. They were, for lack of a better word, I would describe both Atiyah and Roger, who I haven't seen in a while,
mm-hmm.
as Tom McCall Republicans,
yeah.
right? It's moderate
yeah.
Republicans.
Yeah.
I think Ferrioli and McLean are not...
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't want that label.
Mm-hmm.
I think the state has become more blue
yeah.
over time. Part of it has been really interesting for me, and Governor Atiyah represented Washington County, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I came in, most of Washington County was
yeah.
red.
Yeah.
It is now blue. And we call it the urbanization of the suburbs,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You've got a coffee shop on every corner, and people want the same amenities in the suburbs that they have in
right.
downtown Portland or
right.
downtown Beaverton or wherever. So just the numbers have changed.
Right.
So I think it's both philosophical and practical on
right.
their part that they're not running.
Right. So why did you decide to run?
I wanted
You've
to run.
You've been in for a long time.
Yes, I've
like
been in
Vic,
for 17
in for
years. I was 46 or 47.
Mm-hmm.
I had led the Democrats. I mean, I spent 8 to 10 years as the caucus leader.
Yeah.
That was a lot of time and energy raising money,
right.
You know, setting agendas, doing the work. I was ready for a new challenge, but I was very passionate about a couple of issues.
Mm-hmm.
One was the elections issues,
mm-hmm.
and the initiative process and what was happening to the initiative process at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of conversations happening about the fraud in the initiative process. The other piece was my personal experience as a young legislator running against Judy Bauman Shiprack,
mm-hmm.
and beating her by 7 votes,
mm-hmm.
and the importance of every vote. The other was my role as caucus leader and negotiating budgets for, I'd been in that end of session room for 10 years,
yeah.
and figuring out, I'd read a book called The Price of Government, David Osborne and Peter Grunt, I can't think of his last name, Peter Hutchison,
mm-hmm.
and the ability to take a look at how we deliver services through the audits division. Were key to me, and then just ready for a new challenge. Like,
mm-hmm.
was I going to stay in the Senate and be Peter Courtney's lieutenant,
right. Right.
or was I going to, you know, grow my skills and have an opportunity to represent the entire state?
Okay.
So,
how long did that decision making process take for you? Did you look at it a couple of years out? Were you looking at kind of as the elections neared? I mean,
It was pretty much during the 07 legislative session.
Okay.
I was in Earl's district.
Mm-hmm.
I had Earl clearly going to be there a long time,
yeah.
not feeling like Congress was where I felt like I could make a huge difference,
mm-hmm.
and ready to move on and face some new challenges.
Okay, yeah. Vic's decision making was a little bit more compressed because he never really thought about the next election. And that's one of his principles.
Mm-hmm.
Govern like you're going to lose the next election. Just govern to do what's right. And it paid off for him in every election except the one he lost to Strzok.
Yes.
In his legislative elections, though, he only had competition once. He thought he was going to lose an election in 1964, and he won it. But as he was driving to the courthouse to see who won, he heard he lost. And he was in his mind saying, well, it's been fun. And then he won. But so it's fascinating. Legislatively, he basically had a romp through most of his elections. Gubernatorially, he had
challenging
races every time.
So I think the economics really
mm-hmm.
determined his ability to win,
mm-hmm.
I think. And
mm-hmm.
it was 78 was his first election. I think Straub benefited. He had McCall's endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was some, you know, let's give Straub his due
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was sort of the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
78, you know, the path was clearly his.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
82, it was clearly his.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Ted was just funny on that.
He says until Sizemore, he was always the one who said,
exactly.
who lost his gubernatorial election
exactly.
by more votes than any other candidate, end quote. So
exactly.
all I know that still probably stings to this day at some level for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Time for about one more.
Okay.
So
can we just do this every day?
exactly.
I'll lose my job.
Yeah. So you were thinking, I imagine, you were thinking about running for governor anyway at some point down the line. What do you think the advantage of holding statewide office already was for thinking about the governor? I mean, we could traditionally looked at the Secretary of State as it's one of the ways to get to the governor's position. Vic, though, went straight from the legislature.
Yes.
And the Secretary of State thing hasn't worked
for a while. Right.
And
it worked for Hatfield, right?
Yeah, Hatfield, Barbara,
McCall.
Worked for McCall, yeah.
So I think for me,
mm-hmm.
the executive experience
mm-hmm.
Taught me some very important lessons
mm-hmm.
that have been useful in the governor's office.
Okay.
And I am, the executive experience to me, managing an agency,
mm-hmm.
figuring out how you envision a project, our website, our small business advocate, and then implement the project
yeah.
have been extremely useful. If you've got a state division director who is struggling, how do you help him or her to get the best out of, you know, their team? That experience has been extremely valuable for me in this role as governor.
Yeah. Vic, in effect, gets that because he's a real hands-on member of the legislature who works with people like that.
Yes.
So that's
But I also would argue that his experience as a businessman, and I know it was a, you know, it was a smaller family-owned business, but it's the same. How do you empower people, right? How do you give them the tools to innovate and deliver state services more effectively to Oregonians? Yeah. I mean, he would... He gets that.
And you need to know that even when he was governor, his brothers consulted with him on all their hiring decisions. And they were just, Vic in effect forced the brothers to retire because they were all about that age. But it was just fascinating. The brothers saw that too. That's why he was the president. He had been in the business longer because the brothers were in World War II and then came back. Vic had to take over the business immediately when his dad died in 1944.
And then we don't have time for this, but he was also very gutsy in terms of the revenue issues. You mentioned that, the gross receipts tax,
the income tax surcharge.
We tried that, remember, in 2001-03? Yeah. Yeah. We had, it was the Dirty Dozen, it was 13 members. That's how we lost Bruce Starr.
Yeah.
That's how Susan Morgan did not get to be the co-chair of, of Ways and Means. But that was a solution that the legislature came to the table around. It was a Vic Atiyah style solution.
Yeah, but the tax conversation is completely different.
Yes, it totally is.
And he was there at the beginning of that was happening.
Yes.
You know, fighting the Prop 5.
And they did the kicker.
Yeah, the kicker, which I think I've got it nailed down, started with a Democrat.
I think so. No, I think you're absolutely right in that.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris is getting nervous.
Get nervous.
We can do this forever. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And then after the election, I'd love to come out. I know your classes are pretty small at Pacific. It would be fun, though, to do maybe we can figure out something.
Well, because I got my parties and elections class.
Okay.
It would be really great. They're going to be doing presentations, but it'd be good to have one day when they don't do presentations and, you know, like you come in.
Okay.
It's just, you know, don't tell them, just say. There we go.
It's good to see you.
Good
thank
to see you.
So much.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Chris, for putting this together.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Thank you so much.
So when you do have the book ready and the chapter finished, if you use anything from the interview, I would love to see it.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I think what I'm going to end up doing is...